We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. In a recent speech to leaders of NATO, the U.S. Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, said that tanks, bombers, and missiles were no longer enough to keep Europe and the United States safe. She said that we also need tools to keep our cyber networks safe. And she is certainly just the last in a string of people, now going back some years, involved in government here in the United States, who try to remind us that the United States is vulnerable to some kind of cyber attack. So just how vulnerable is this country, either to an attack by, say, a terrorist group or even a foreign government? In this hour of Focus, we'll try to talk a little bit about what can be done to make cyberspace safer and more secure. And our guest for the program is Dr. Herb Lin. He's a chief scientist at the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board of the National Research Council of the National Academies in Washington, D.C. He's there been working for some time as a study director of some major projects on public policy and information technology. Just to name one, a study from 2007 looking at cybersecurity research. That's titled Toward a Safer and More Secure Cyberspace. Also, a current project he's involved in is one looking at policy consequences and legal and ethical implications of offensive information warfare. Prior to his getting involved at the National Research Council, he was professional staff member and also staff scientist for the House Armed Services Committee, where his portfolio included defense policy and arms control issues. He was scheduled to be here on the campus to give a talk today, Understanding U.S. Cyber Attack Policy. That was set for this afternoon. His visit here sponsored by the folks at the Information Trust Institute, Computer Science, and also the Program in Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. And he, like a lot of folks out on the East Coast, is dealing with the effects of the big snowstorm that they had. So he wasn't able to make it. Perhaps at some future point he'll be here on the campus, and we would hope to welcome him to this program. But this morning we'll be talking with him by telephone. We're glad that he could spend some time with us. The telephone numbers, if you would like to join in the conversation, are, first of all, for local folks, 333-9455. So if you're in Champaign-Urbana, use that number. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it's a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. And you may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. So whichever way you want to do it, certainly your comments and questions are welcome in the conversation. Dr. Lin, hello.
Hi there.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Appreciate it being here.
Well, you know, this is something that I think for going back now a number of years, there have been people, policy people, saying that this is certainly something that we should be aware of and prepare for, that, and that is that the United States is vulnerable to this kind of attack, a cyber attack. And I mentioned here the recent comments by Secretary of State Clinton, and she's just the one in a number of people who are saying, yes, this is important. And I think that, that the Obama administration has perhaps taken more steps to formalize, to create a formal process to look at these issues. Do you think it is the case that now this this vulnerability is getting more attention than it has in the past?
Certainly, certainly it's been getting more attention now than it has in the past. I mean, every administration has paid more attention to it. Even within administrations, you can see the growth of attention to the subject. So yes, the short version is every administration has paid more attention to it, and it is becoming increasingly prominent on the security and public policy agenda.
Mm-hmm. Now, it seems that there are perhaps a number of levels on which you can talk about this, and that we can talk about different things. We can talk about cyber warfare. Mm-hmm. We can talk about cyber terrorism, and we can talk about things that might be done on the level of a state as part of its defense posture. And also, of course, we know that a lot of trouble can be caused by malicious individuals if basically what they're just trying to do for whatever reason is cause trouble.
Right.
But what exactly is the difference between, say, cyber warfare and cyber terrorism?
I could turn that question around and say, what's the difference between warfare and terrorism without the cyber adjective? Mostly people think about warfare as acts become between states, between nation states. That's what a lot of the current international law regarding governance of conflict is based on. So it's based on the idea that there is a nation that can attack or not attack another nation, and that certain nations have certain rights to respond and so on. Terrorism is almost always regarded as a non-state action, not under the direct control of some national government. And those definitions are good enough to, at least for a starting point, to consider talking about it in the cyber context as well.
Well, if given that we know that malicious individuals can cause a lot of problems and have, what's the difference? Perhaps what's the difference in magnitude of the kind of damage that could be caused by an individual on the one hand or a state if what they decided to do was to put significant resources into having the machinery so that they could carry out a cyber attack on another country?
Well, so for example, let me give you an example of the sort of thing that you might be concerned about. What you've done, correctly so, is to say, at the low end, sort of there's individuals, and individuals can be very sophisticated, but the high end, there are nation states, and what could they do? And they're going to be more sophisticated. And so an interesting question that you raise is, how much more sophisticated? Well, let me give you some sense of that. What an individual can do is limited by the kinds of things that one person can do. A nation state, by contrast, has its entire treasury and its intelligence apparatus and its national security establishment behind it. And so the resources that it can bring to bear, both in terms of the technical expertise and access, and I'll comment on that in a second, as well as financial resources, is just vastly greater, orders of magnitude greater than for in the case of an individual. What do I mean by access? Well, one of the things that intelligence agencies are known to do is collect information, right? So, and they can collect information on at a very detailed level in ways that individuals don't have the wherewithal to collect themselves. So, for example, one of the things that a cyber attack might depend on is knowledge of the specific configuration of the laptop belonging to the prime minister or something like that. An individual would have essentially zero chance of finding out that information. An intelligence agency might have a better chance of knowing something about the laptop that belonged to the prime minister of Albania. And that kind of information could be very useful in conducting an attack on that computer.
Well, that, I suppose, that also suggests that there is, we talked just a little bit about cyber warfare as state policy, we talked a little bit about cyber terrorism. I guess this suggests that there is a third area, and there are some ways in which all of these maybe overlap a little bit, but the third area would be something that we might call cyber espionage that could be done by a state. I suppose it all, and the target could be another government. It could be done by a state, and the target could be private industry. How now important a spy tool has the internet, in a sense, become?
At one level, the answer is very clear to anybody who uses Google. That is, you can use the internet completely openly to get all kinds of information that you'd never be able to get. That would be very hard to get in any other context in a pre-Google world. So there's lots of information that's just sitting out there for the taking, and sort of this open source information is a very powerful thing for people who want to gather intelligence. Is something that is gaining increasing prominence in intelligence circles. But that's not the sort of thing you mean. I think the sort of thing you mean is actually breaking into a computer and then stealing information from it, and that's a reasonable distinction to make. So let me give you the 30-second primer.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about cyber attacks, normally the people on the inside ought to be thinking, or they're thinking about actions that will degrade or destroy or disrupt an adversary's, a target's information technology system or network or the information therein. So you actually want to do something bad to it so it works less well, you corrupt data, you damage the computer, something like that. Cyber espionage, or what more precisely in the business, something called cyber exploitation, refers to the process of stealing information from the other guy's information technology system in a way that, in the best possible case, he never knows that you've been there. He thought that it was well protected. It isn't now. You go in there and you get it, and he never knows that you're there. But now you have it, and you have an advantage over him because he doesn't know that you have it. So cyber exploitation is a big deal. Mostly these days in the press, in the popular press, newspaper accounts, and so on, they don't distinguish between cyber attacks and cyber exploitation. And cyber attacks are used to lump together this destructive notion that I described with this obtaining information notion that I described. Caution to the listener. If you read about a cyber attack, make sure you ask which one of those things is really happening.
Yeah. Our guest, just to introduce very quickly, Dr. Herb Lin, is a chief scientist at the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board of the National Research Council of the National Academies in Washington, D.C., where he's been the study director of a number of major projects on public policy and information technology. And we're talking this morning about cyber warfare, cyber attacks, and just how vulnerable is the United States? What is the country doing to try to prepare? And in fact, is the United States involved in doing the same thing? Questions and comments certainly welcome. Here in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And we do have that email, that's will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe we should talk a little bit more about what one might achieve by doing such a thing, by using the internet as an avenue of attack. And I suppose one could imagine a number of things that you could do to make life difficult for people just as individuals, and then also make it difficult for government to do what it does. When you talk about cyber warfare, what exactly are you talking about?
Well, so one of the things that people have done recently is characterize the cyber attacks on Estonia and Georgia as the first battles in the future digital war world, or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
In these instances, for example, the websites of important websites of Estonia, including financial institutions and government agencies and so on, were subject to what's known as a denial of service attack. That is, they were flooded with a lot of bogus requests for service, and that prevented legitimate users from getting access to them. Now, it's important to note in Estonia that lots of that country transacts lots of its business online. So, for example, I understand that well over 90% of their financial transactions, consumer transactions, financial transactions are online. And so if individuals weren't able to get online to do their financial transactions, you could understand how that might get upset. Government websites were also subject to denial of service attack, which meant that the government was unable to get out information to the public about what was going on, and also was unable to get out information to the rest of the country, to the rest of the world about what was going on. And so it is believed by many people that these events were orchestrated by the Russian government. There is no definitive evidence of that, as I understand the situation. What is known, what other people have said is that these attacks were conducted by a rented botnet. A botnet is an instrument, one particular instrument to be used to conduct such attacks. It was rented from some organization, some criminal organization that provides botnet services, botnet attacks for a fee. So they would say, give me X thousand dollars and I'll conduct a botnet attack against the Estonian website for using 100,000 machines for 3 days or whatever the right numbers were, and that's how it happened. Now, who actually paid that money to the owners and operators of the botnet? Nobody knows. So there's lots of ambiguities in tracing a cyber attack to a specific actor. To hold him or her or that party responsible.
And did, when you're talking about an attack like that particular one that you talk about, was this something that did real permanent damage, or was it more something that it was maybe a monstrous inconvenience, but that it was more of a monstrous inconvenience than it was something that resulted in, say, property destruction or people dying?
I'd say it's much more the latter. That is, it's much more of an inconvenience. Hmm. But one can argue that it's an interesting question as to what level of inconvenience constitutes something serious. Estonia has, in fact, declared access to the internet as a fundamental human right. Galia Planet. As a fundamental human right. So presumably that's the equivalent of people need access to information and the internet, just like they need access to food and water and legal process. So I mean that's a very powerful statement. Nevertheless, I would still say that it rises more to the level of inconvenience than a serious threat to life, liberty, and property.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose it's also true that if truly we were talking about war, and a more conventional kind of war was being waged with tanks and bombs and airplanes, that if you did this kind of thing at the same time, that would make it more of a problem for the target of the attack. So if this is an adjunct kind of set of weaponry, if this is another front, you can see that would, for an attacker, that could have potential uses and that it could pose very serious problems for the person who was the victim of the attack.
Absolutely right. I mean, there's the scenarios that involve war as war. Are those which involve cyber weaponry being used just like just like other weapons, that is using, for example, just to illustrate, using a cyber attack, for example, to take out an air defense system to let the bombers go in unmolested. So you could imagine doing that. Now, whether that's the best way to do it or not, depends on the specifics of the situation. But one could at least imagine that cyber would give you an additional means for disabling that air defense system. Because, mostly you don't care if an air defense system is operating. You only care about it when your planes are going through. And you might use a cyber attack to bring it down just for that period of time.
Mm-hmm. There has been a lot of reporting recently on this kind of activity by China, according to a recent report, this was something done by the FBI, and the stories that I've read about it said it was classified, so I don't know how it is that people who wrote about this have found out, but in any case, this classified FBI report says that China has actually developed well, I don't know if army is the right way to describe it, but at least in the wording of one of the stories that I'm looking at, that's what it says. Cyber spies, 30,000 people who are in the Chinese military and 150,000 people who are in the private sector, whose mission it is to carry out these kinds of attacks, at least initially to do probably what would be called cyber espionage. But clearly it seems that as a part of their defense strategy, they're saying this is important. As far as you know, as far as the United States knows, is China the country that has put the most resources into this, as far as we know?
I don't know. I know what is commonly believed. And getting insight into the structure of the People's Liberation Army at the kind of detailed level that you're talking about is a very difficult task. Made much more difficult by the fact that people who specialize in this stuff can be sitting in rooms and they never have to drive a tank or fly an airplane, right? I think that it's very much more difficult in this space to understand what the magnitude of effort is. So I would have to find, if you quoted numbers like 30,000 in the PLA and 150,000 in the private sector, mm-hmm. I'd have to have some detailed accounting of that in order to understand where that came from, and I just don't know.
I suppose, though, it's safe to assume that there are a number of countries that are putting resources into this very effort and that the United States is among them.
No question about that. I mean, the Chinese have written, Chinese military theorists have written about the advantages of using information as an asymmetric as an asymmetric offset to our superiority in the air and on the sea, so certainly the Chinese have been militaries have been interested in this, but the American militaries have also been interested in this as well, although the activities of the American military in this are very, very highly classified.
Mm-hmm. So that's why it is we don't know as much. I'm not really sure why it is we know so much about China, but we don't know that much about what the United States is doing.
That's absolutely right. Absolutely right. That the United States mostly our view in the United States is here we are, and there is bad guys are doing all these things to us. And there's just no discussion at all about what we're doing to other countries. No public discussion about it.
Yeah, but again, that we're assuming that that we're putting resources into this. The Chinese are, the Russians are, the British are, the French are, the Japanese. Probably everybody is doing this.
Lots of people are certainly putting resources in. There's no question about that.
Yeah, and not that. I suppose there should be no reason to assume, particularly that the Chinese hackers are any better than French hackers or British hackers or Japanese hackers or American hackers, that it might, if there's a difference in performance, it might have mostly to do with just how much resources you decide that you're going to put into this?
Well, no, not necessarily. If you take if you just sort of think about how talent would be distributed around the population, okay, the saying in China is that if you're one in a million, then there are 1,300 of you just like you, right? And the United States, that number is 300. It's not an accident that the tallest guy in the NBA is Chinese. That is, when you have 1.5 billion people to choose from, the guys at the extreme ends of that distribution on whatever scale, whether it's height or hacker talent, are almost certainly going to be better than if you can get the extremes of the distribution if you have 300 million people. The best Chinese my guess is that they are probably better than the best Americans in this, just on that basis. Now, maybe the United States maybe Americans have superiority of training, and maybe they haven't. The Chinese haven't actually identified these people, and maybe the smartest guys are really who would be good at this are still living out in the fields, and they're digging trenches in the soil and so on. And so we'll have some advantages along those lines for some time. But in the long run, the 1.5 billion people are going to, the best of those people are probably going to pose a big challenge to us. Hmm.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Dr. Herb Lin. He is a chief scientist at the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board, National Research Council of the National Academies in Washington, D.C., where he's been the study director of a number of major projects on public policy and information technology. And just to name one, a 2007 study on cybersecurity research toward a safer and more secure cyberspace. Also, right now, he's involved in a project looking at some of the policy consequences and legal and ethical implications of offensive information warfare. He was scheduled to be here to give a talk on the campus of the University of Illinois this afternoon and got hung up, like a lot of people on the East Coast, by the weather, so he wasn't able to make it here to the campus. Perhaps some future date he will, and we can have him here in the studio at that point. But he was good enough to say yes, he'd spend the time with us on the telephone so we could have the discussion we had planned to talk about cyber attack as a tool of national policy. That is the topic. And questions are welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do also have an email that's will-talk@illinois.edu. One of the things that apparently makes trying to prepare for or defend against a cyber attack very difficult, and one respect in which it's different than a more kind of conventional attack, is that there is little or nothing in the way of early warning. That with other kinds of warfare, it seems to follow a predictable curve. There may be some sorts of things in the way of buildup that you can see. But with cyber attack, there's apparently almost nothing like that. If that is in fact the case, then is it possible for you to develop some kind of early warning system for a cyber attack?
I think the what you just said is true in some contexts and not in others. So a context in which it is true is, for example, an attack in which the intent is to block service. So it's certainly possible to mount a large-scale denial-of-service attack with very little warning. So and all of a sudden, the websites that you rely on will become unavailable to you. So that's possible. So you're right about that. There are other kinds of cyber attacks, perhaps more subtle kinds of cyber attacks, that would in fact take a long time to organize. So, for example, if I wanted to to use a cyber attack to cripple oil and gas production, okay, it might take a very long time to implant your software agents, your malicious software agents, in the control systems of critical oil and gas facilities. Whether or not you could do that, that would be an open question. You might not, because once you planted the first three, and then while you're planting four, five, and six, somebody discovers the first two. And either takes them out or raises a flag or something like that. So it's not quite fair to say that there's never any warning of a cyber attack, but it's certainly true that, if you didn't notice all of these guys being implanted, then you could be up the creek without a paddle. That is certainly true.
Mm-hmm. And then you could have this malware would have been installed and be in place. In fact, it could be in place for a long time.
That's right.
Before it was with the proverbial mouse click, before it was told to do what it was supposed to do.
Exactly right. Exactly right. So in that sense, there's no warning. But if you had been good enough to detect the early, the early signs of that, then maybe that's not quite a fair statement. I mean, so for example, one of the things this is a very interesting issue that comes up. If you're a nation, if you're some party, doesn't have to be a nation, and let's say you're conducting espionage, cyber espionage against somebody. So what you do is you put in a malicious software agent whose job is to scan the systems that you're on and send back interesting information. Okay, you can do that, and as such, that agent is an exploitation, is an espionage agent. But it would be very easy, of course, to equip that system, that agent, with some destructive capabilities, so that when it gets a signal from the outside, it deletes all of the files and crashes the system that it's running on, for example. That would be more destructive, more malicious. And then you ask the interesting question: was this an attack before it launched the attack, before it did its destructive thing? Was it an attack agent? Well, yeah, it was an attack agent, but it wasn't doing anything bad. It wasn't doing anything destructive. It was sending out information, which is bad, but it wasn't doing anything destructive. So, is that an attack? And let's take it. I can bring it down to the most limiting case. Let's say it was just a shell in which I penetrate the system and I put in a shell, and its job is just to receive a later payload. That is, I can download then to it an exploitation, an espionage payload, or an attack payload. And now the shell doesn't do anything, but it provides the toehold for either an exploitation or an attack to occur. So this question about what counts as an exploitation and an attack are very, very fuzzy. Mm.
Clearly, people in government recognize this as a problem, but I think that some people have said private industry has not taken it seriously enough. Do you think that that is the case?
I think that seriously enough, I don't, there's a, what you've done is you've compared government who've taken it seriously, who believe this is a problem, to private industry who doesn't take it seriously enough. I think both private industry and government recognize that there are problems here. The interesting question then is, what do they do about it? And one can make a very good argument, which we have in a number of Academy reports, that the private sector has failed to incentivize the private sector, to take the market forces have failed to incent the private sector to take adequate action for cybersecurity from the whole from the standpoint of the nation as a whole. That is, they will pay attention to those cybersecurity risks that cause them immediate danger. And they manage them as business risks, but the high consequence, low probability events, they don't spend enough effort or resources on mitigating. And so, how you should respond to that situation is an open question, on which I'm personally agnostic. But I think there's a broad recognition that market forces alone haven't forced the private sector. Haven't made the private sector pay enough attention to cybersecurity. Mm-hmm. There's a question of whether or not the federal government pays enough attention to cybersecurity as well, but that's not what you ask.
And then there's the question of, should the federal government say to the private sector, look, you guys have to wake up here. Not only are your operations jeopardized, but the security of the country is jeopardized.
That's right. That is a question. There are many people who advocate that point of view.
It seems that one of the big problems that we have here now is that everything is increasingly connected. Uh-huh. And I suppose that it is true that if you have some some system that would be vulnerable to attack that you want to protect, you know, let's say the operating system for a nuclear power plant or something, that you can, I think that it's possible to isolate that system, to make it a closed system so that you cannot access it from some remote location. But it seems that the problem is that most everything is one way or another accessible first from some remote location. And so I wonder whether it's actually possible, particularly for critical systems, for them to be protected sufficiently, or that's just part of the price we pay for the system that we have, and that there's not a whole lot you can do about that.
Well, so let me give you an example, okay? It is my understanding that there are some electrical generation facilities that are directly, whose operation, that is, the pump speeds and the power that they put out and the generator speeds and so on, that are actually controlled off of internet received off of internet based systems. Okay. Now, this is to me a very dumb thing to do. You don't want to have your systems that are generating power for a city on the internet. Okay. So you say, let's not do that. Okay, so you break that connection and you say, well, I don't have to do that anymore, and so you say now the generating facilities are safe. But then there's the guys at the utility company say, but we need to monitor our power generation purposes to know what we're going to price it at and stuff like that. So what they do is they put their administrative and business computers and financial computers, and they interconnect them with the generating facility so they get the real-time data. Okay. And, of course, these financial systems and financial systems and business systems are connected to the generating facilities, and the financial systems and business systems are connected to the Internet. So, you know, how do you break that link? And how do you provide incentives for breaking that link completely? And it turns out that that's actually a very hard problem to do, to solve.
Hmm. Well, at the very least, I'm sure that if it's possible for a malicious person or persons, no matter what kind of access they have, to cause some problems, although I would think that if you're going to mess up somebody's accounting, that it's not quite the same thing as if you can have command and control of the generators.
Oh, that's not what I'm talking about. Yes, you could mess up the accounting through the internet, but I'm not talking about that. What I'm talking about is that now that you have access to the accounting systems, you use that just as a conduit to get to the generators.
Oh, so it's still
effectively connected to the internet,
I see,
only indirectly.
I see. Yeah. All right. We have a caller. We'd welcome others. We're moving into about our last 10 minutes of this part of Focus 580. And let me again introduce our guest, Dr. Herb Lin. He's the chief scientist at the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board at the National Research Council of the National Academies in Washington, D.C., where he's been the study director of a number of major projects on public policy and information technology. And we're talking about cybersecurity and a cyber attack as a tool of national policy. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a caller in Geneva, line number 4. Hello.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, you know what? The security thing is a big issue with this computer thing. I actually think that you hear from year to year how many people or how many cyber attacks we've had, and they get sensitive information. I mean, I think last year didn't they come up with something from the Pentagon? They issued a statement after somebody blew the whistle. I honestly think if the terrorists were going to go after us, it's probably going to be the way. Everybody all thinks I'm nuts, but I mean, how else would you? It just makes, I don't know. Anyway, long story short is I get. Constantly, I've got like Norton antivirus popping up all the time as a security alert. I've got other things. I know other people have with their computers. They constantly being attacked from either viruses or somebody wanting to get information. And I have with mine noticed that if I click on anything on Google, I get more ads. So the information, somebody, you know, out there, it's kind of like, you know, the telemarketer. I think there's, all of a sudden I noticed that there's people that have more information than need be about myself on the computer. So I know for a fact that these guys are out there doing stuff. I firmly believe in another couple of years when my wife retires from work, I'm going to go find myself a place somewhere out in the middle of nowhere, build myself a house, put a generator on it, try to put wind turbine. I'm looking, doing research on it. I want to be totally self-sufficient and as much off the grid as possible, because someday that might happen. Or, you know, I don't trust the big companies in the first place. So I think that's, everybody ought to look into that. I really do. I think the way the country is going, we need to be more self-sufficient anyways. But I just wanted to get your take on that and see if I'm being paranoid about it or what.
All right. Well, Dr. Lynn, what do you think?
Well, our guest has you know, has in some ways the right idea that you know, people should be prepared for disaster. As I'm talking to you right now, I'm in the middle of a you know, in the wake of a huge storm in Washington D.C. that knocked out power in my house, and I'm I was fortunate enough to have a camp stove where I could use to heat up food. You know, we lost power for a day and a half, and it's still out. I'm told that it won't come back for a week. So there's a certain amount of self-sufficiency that I think is definitely a good idea for everybody. Ought to have adequate food supplies and so on. But it's very difficult to be completely isolated, that's a really tough thing to do. You could certainly cut yourself off from the internet; that's fine, but then you'd lose a lot of the benefits of being connected. And some people make that choice, and it's a perfectly reasonable choice. But you know, I would find it very difficult to do that, and my daughter would find it even more difficult to do that. So I think that just complete isolation probably isn't the way to go. How much isolation and in what ways? I think that's the question, and that becomes much harder.
Other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, you raise another sort of another question, but it's something that that we're reminded of from time to time, and that is that we can have natural disasters of varying scales. You can have a paralyzing snowstorm. You can have an ice storm and all the power lines come down. You could have a tornado. You could have an earthquake. You could have any number of things that will disrupt people's lives. And the standard advice we are given is you really should be prepared for that sort of thing, and that you should have some in your house. You should have some water, and you should have some canned food. And if you rely on prescription medicines, you should make sure that you have enough of that. And you should have flashlight and battery-operated radio. And, you know, this is a fairly standard list of good things that people should have. And maybe there are indeed some people who do, but I'm guessing that probably most people don't. And as many times as we've heard that we don't do it. And that makes you wonder, do you think that the government should make more of an effort to get that message out to people and to say, if there is some sort of disaster, and I'm sure the message actually already has been given out, but the message, if there is some sort of disaster, we will manage to get there eventually, but that you really ought to be prepared to take care of yourself and your basic needs for at least a day or two. And then I think that's something that most people would simply not prepared for.
I think you're right about that. But the government has been trying to say this in a very loud voice ever since 9/11. I can tell you that you know, my colleagues and even my family has looked at me askance when I am trying to improve emergency planning by you know, stockpiling water and things like that. You know, it's not something that they particularly want to you know, that people particularly want to think about. So you know, every now and then it comes in handy.
We're coming down to the point where we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of the show. I mentioned a couple times that you're involved in this current project looking at some of the legal policy consequences, legal ethical implications of offensive information warfare. And I should have asked before now, but I'm interested in what are some of the particularly the ethical but also the legal implications of doing this and not just doing what you can to be prepared in case of such an attack, but to actually be involved if not carrying out such attacks, at least having the capability that you can call on if you decide that you need that.
Right. So the issue here is that cyber attack certainly been used against us, and it might be something that we would want to use against another party, some adversary. And so when you start thinking about it in those terms as an instrument of policy, all kinds of issues come up that you wouldn't have to think about if you just had to defend against them. The analogy that I use is that if the bad guys have guns and the good guys only have bulletproof vests, then the policy issues aren't really very much. But if you start giving cops guns, then you start to have to think about things like liability and training and insurance and rules of engagement and targeting and all those sorts of things. The bad guys never have to think about any of those things. So in other words, if you're going to use a weapon that can cause harm to someone else, you have to start really thinking those issues through about what you want to do and what's appropriate and what's not as a nation. Let me give you an interesting example of this. By policy, if you see an Air Force jet or a Navy jet, you see an insignia on it that identifies it as an American, as an instrument of the U.S. military. There's stars on it and there's stripes on it and so on. It's an American airplane. There's American soldiers that they wear uniforms who are uniquely identifiable as Americans, okay, as part of the American military. So let's say we launch a cyber attack and we put in an attack instrument into somebody else's system. Does that mean there has to be something in it that says this software agent is a bona fide instrument of the U.S. government? This is an attack being conducted by the U.S. government? To ask the question, it sounds really ridiculous. Why would we ever want to do that? But those are the kinds of questions that you start asking, because attacks with cyber are inherently deniable. And, whereas, with an airplane, maybe it isn't. So there are all kinds of interesting legal and ethical issues that start to come up there.
Well, isn't that just, and I have a caller I want to get to, but right away I start thinking, well, the equivalent of branding your cyber attack would be like taking somebody in the CIA and giving them a sweatshirt that says CIA in big letters on it. I mean, isn't there this principle that, in fact, people do things undercover and that's just part of the game?
Well, there is this category of action called covert action, which is strictly regulated under the U.S. Under U.S. law, which has to do with actions that are taken that are plausibly deniable. That is, where it's intended that the U.S. government where the involvement of the U.S. government is not apparent. But that's usually not what we use our military for. Military forces are identified as military forces of the U.S. military. That's what they have the insignia for.
Let's take one more caller here at least, Urbana. Line one. Hello.
Just one more suggestion for personal emergency preparedness. Mm-hmm. So many people now only have a cell phone. And if the power is out and your cell phone can't find a tower very easily, it quickly runs down. I've started carrying a second battery. I have a landline, too. And I'm thinking, there's so many people we wouldn't be able to reach if their cell phones run down. It might be good to know, if you only have a cell phone, who in your neighborhood or who near where you hang out has a landline, which the landlines can go down in a bad storm, but landlines can have their own power. And I'm not sure how that works, but they can be reliable in other situations. I found it useful even just to have a spare battery for when my cell phone runs down and I don't have, and I am not able to charge it for some reason. I think I might, now that I think about it, go out and even get another one and keep it charged up. Thanks very much. Interesting program.
All right. Thank you. Well, it sounds like sound advice to me.
It's a good idea. I actually do have a spare cell phone battery, so.
I do. What it does also make me think about all those people who have cut the landline. I guess in our house we actually still have a landline, and that's why, because we don't completely trust the other network. And if we really needed to call for help, it's nice to know that it's there.
That's right.
Well, we're coming down to the point. We have maybe about a minute or so left. You talked about the fact that, you know, we've actually seen cyber attacks, the ones that you talked about a little earlier that took place in Estonia. And I'm forgetting me, where was the?
Georgia.
Right, Georgia and Estonia that were allegedly that the Russians were behind, even though they said, of course, not. Do you think that that's the kind of thing that we're likely to, and there have been some certainly some questions about the Chinese, and they're doing what probably counts as cyber espionage. Is this, though, something that you would say we should expect to start to hear more about this, actual attacks having been made?
Yes, I think that this is going to become an increasingly large part of the public policy agenda, and people are going to pay more and more attention to it. And the number of cyber incidents that are going to be front page news is going to just go up.
And so what sort of things are we doing to try to, as a matter of policy for the country, to try and be as prepared as we can?
Well, so, for example, in December, President Obama named the cybersecurity czar, who has responsibility for coordinating federal action to defend U.S. cyberspace. That person has been now on the job for a month and a half or so, something like that. And he has a monumental task in front of him. Nobody in Washington believes that this job is going to be easy, but at least there's somebody there now that who has the portfolio for worrying about this problem sort of on a full-time basis.
Mm-hmm. Well, there we'll have to leave it. Our guest, Dr. Herb Lin, is chief scientist at the Computer Science and Telecommunications Board, National Research Council of the National Academies, Washington, D.C., where he's been the study director of a number of major projects on public policy and information technology. He was going to be on the campus here today, and the weather prevented him getting out of the East Coast, but perhaps on another day he'll be visiting, and we can talk then. And in the meantime, certainly you're interested in reading on this subject and taking a look at some of the other things that they're doing there at the National Research Council. You can go to the web and do that. And Dr. Lin, thank you very much.
Okay, I appreciate being here, and I'm told that my visit will be rescheduled for some time either this semester or next.
All right. Well, when you're in town, you can be on the show. We'd be happy to have you with us.
Thanks.
Thank you.